This is the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. On today's episode, we'll examine what U.S. policy toward Latin America might look like if President Biden wins a second term, including how Washington will manage its increasing competition with China in the region.
The United States, we need to be, I think, more sophisticated in terms of our messaging about what our concerns are with respect to China's presence in the Americas, and really zero in on those and make sure that our message is not just avoid that relationship altogether, because that's just not realistic.
We can't quite predict the future here at the America's Quarterly Podcast, but save extraordinary events, we know that we will have a repeat president in the United States, either Joe Biden or Donald Trump, following the election in November. And we've been asking ourselves, what would another Biden or Trump administration mean in terms of policy toward Latin America? For answers, we've brought in people with intimate knowledge of both camps. We did this a few weeks ago in an interview with Carlos Trujillo, who is the ambassador to the Organization of American States during the Trump years. If you haven't heard that one, you can find it on our podcast page. And now, today, we'll hear from Ricardo Zuniga. Ricardo had a distinguished 30-year career at the State Department. Prior to his retirement last September, he played a major role on Latin America policy under the Obama and Biden administrations. Today, Ricardo is a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute of Peace and a founding partner of Dinamica Americas, a strategic advisory firm that helps companies and others navigate conditions in the Americas. In this special episode, we'll review President Biden's policies towards Latin America over the past 4 years, from the U.S.-Mexico relationship to trade to Venezuela to how the U.S.-China competition will play out in Latin America, and several other simple questions, and try to figure out what the next 4 years might bring. So, let's get started. Ricardo, welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast.
Thank you, Brian.
Ricardo, one common refrain I've heard a lot over the years is that the Biden administration does not have a policy towards Latin America, that it's somewhat ad hoc, improvised, country by country, and therefore the region as a whole does not get the attention it deserves. I know you've surely heard that over the years yourself. What's your response?
Well, I've only heard that for 30 years. So that is not a new piece of information, but actually there's some interesting pieces there. One, I would say the region itself is highly fragmented. This is a time where you have countries really going in their own direction in many cases, including even within groups like Mercosur. You have much more, I would say, a lack of cohesion in terms of a regional response at this point. So that's one element. I would also challenge it in the sense that it's really impossible to have a single policy towards the Americas. You really have to have a policy that you can't approach South America the same way that you approach Mexico, which is one of our most important relationships globally, and a core partner in so many spheres, or Central America, which has this close proximity to the United States that doesn't exist in South America. And yet South America also matters for its own reasons. And within South America, you're going to have divisions. And then Brazil, you can't deal with Brazil the way that you do the rest of the region, because it's a country that we run into all over the globe. It is a global actor, not just a regional one.
So what I'm hearing is that in your view, the days of a good neighbor policy or an alliance for progress or sort of the big umbrellas that used to be employed to, you know, for U.S. policy towards the region, those days have passed.
It's much more appropriate to have more specialized and more directed approaches. I will say that President Biden approaches the relationships across the region in a lot of ways the same way that he approaches his domestic policy, which is a focus on having democracy delivered to citizens. I mean, he views this very much as a part of the world where you have a lack of faith in the ability of government to actually improve lives, and just as you do in the United States.
But would you concede, Ricardo, at some level that the Biden administration has not given the region the attention that at least people like you and I feel it deserves? I mean, I have been surprised that someone who traveled so often to Latin America as vice president has only been to the region once as president.
Well, he's traveled very little. He, remember his first year, he didn't travel because of COVID. And then by the time we got to, say, a more normal travel environment, it was the war in Ukraine was well underway. And, you know, he's president. He does not have the space or ability to travel as freely as he would have in other positions. In other times, Secretary Blinken has traveled pretty regularly to the region, including on food security, on migration, G20 meetings, obviously in Brazil, but also to Ecuador and Colombia. And that's in the middle of a pretty crazy schedule for a Secretary of State who's managing a host of crises. So, and the Caribbean, I will say that there has been an unprecedented level of engagement with the countries of the Caribbean, starting with the Summit of the Americas.
All right, well, backing up here a bit, I mean, what do you see as the policy successes of President Biden's first term toward Latin America and the Caribbean?
So I reviewed a couple of them in the sense that I think that the COVID response was the one of them that really stands out. I'd say another important contribution is the really close work that the Biden administration has had with multilateral development banks. And for example, the really increasing and tightening the relationship between the IDB and the Development Finance Corporation. On migration, look, that was the other big challenge that was new in the region. We have not had this kind of scale in the history of the region of 20 million people on the road. And the LA Declaration actually was one of the very, I'd say, one of the most important achievements of this administration, because it made it a shared challenge. And it didn't say, you know, it was not specifically or exclusively about enforcement, but about, you know, the countries of the region working together to deal with something that's affecting all of us.
Surprised that you have not yet mentioned Guatemala and Brazil in terms of the support.
So let's talk about that really quickly, Brian, because the underlying challenge in all of this was, in terms of democracy not delivering, democracy is also under threat at a level that we have not seen in decades in the Americas, and for different reasons.
But to be clear, I mean, I'm of the view, more important than me, lots of analysts who follow the country and who follow Latin America believe that the Biden administration's actions were decisive in protecting democracy in Guatemala and ensuring that now President Arevalo was able to take office despite the huge efforts by the judiciary and parts of the political establishment to stop him from doing so. And then a story that you know full well as someone who knows Brazil, Biden administration not as decisive necessarily, but played a role in 2022 in, let's say, dissuading parts of the Brazilian military from trying to prevent or overturn the election result after Jair Bolsonaro lost.
The reason that those elections turned out the way they did was because of the actions of citizens in both of those countries, primarily, first and foremost. And in the case of Guatemala, the United States was able to help tip the scales at the end, particularly on the day of the inauguration itself. U.S. role there was to help regular order triumph. And that was something that required the support, not just of opponents of the prior government, but also a civil society. The indigenous in Guatemala, probably the pivotal actor, but also the private sector by sort of denying support to the more corrupt actors on the political side really helped change the balance in that race. But again, that one, and in Brazil as well, the main factor were local citizens acting in support of democratic outcomes.
Well, there's no doubt in the Brazilian case that it was Brazilian institutions and citizens that were the deciding factor, but certainly also true that the U.S. as well as others in the international community played a role.
So, and Brian, I would just underline that, because here's the thing. If you've worked in this region for 30 years, there is a narrative that the United States stands with sort of conservatives, the private sector, the right wing, let's say, of Latin American society. And that comes from a long legacy from the Cold War era and so forth. But it's just not accurate. It's really about, I mean, I can tell you in the case of Brazil, we made a decision very early on as the election was beginning to be questioned, first that the United States was neutral on the outcome. We certainly knew that if former President Lula won, that it would probably Brazil would be a more complicated actor at the multilateral level. And that was not a factor in our position, because it would have been a much greater disaster for the United States to have the second largest democracy in the Americas and the only Western democracy in the BRICS, for instance, just for one example, have a question about their democratic credentials. And so certainly the message that we sent was, we don't care who wins. We don't have a horse in that race, but we have a very strong national interest in whether Brazil has a successful democracy or not. That's important to the United States.
I know it's impossible to know because it's counterfactual, but do you believe a Trump administration would have done the same thing in Brazil or Guatemala?
No, I don't think they would have. The Trump administration was less interested in democratic outcomes or in democracy, let's say, than in having a transactional relationship. And it just has, I mean, that comes from a worldview that is much more transactional, that it's not about institutions or about principled commitments or a world order. It's about transactional relationships. And there were many people in Latin America who were quite comfortable with that.
They would say, the Trump people, I suspect, would say that, well, it's about interests. And
that's right.
The U.S. national interest is that countries collaborate on areas like migration and drug interdiction. And apart from that, you know, what happens is sort of their business.
So except that their business becomes our business very quickly.
The flip side of that, though, and this is something that people outside the Latin America space don't always appreciate, is that some governments in the region actually preferred working with the Trump administration as opposed to the Biden administration, because they understood that as long as they played ball in areas like migrants and drugs, that the Trump administration would, for the most part, leave them alone.
Absolutely. That's the fundamental formula.
Before we move on from the regional discussion and get into kind of country by country specifics, I do want to come back and ask you, I mean, again, this idea that I started out with, this idea that the Biden administration has not paid enough attention to the region, it's not just a criticism you hear amongst people in the U.S. I mean, I have heard it regularly from government officials all over the region, specifically with the question of, you know, what looked at one point like it was going to be the most visible policy towards Latin America, which was the focus on quote unquote root causes of migration in Central America, for which the vice president, Kamala Harris, was appointed to that role and kind of started with a bang. And then I think it's fair to say receded somewhat. You don't hear much about that issue. You don't see her so much on that cause anymore. I mean, again, this view that there's just, and people understand that there's crises in Ukraine and Middle East and China's a big question, but even within that there's just not the bandwidth, especially at senior level, where you have officials who don't really have a past in the region itself. You know, Ricardo, I mean, looking at those criticisms, is there any other area where you feel like a second Biden administration would be positioned to do better, to improve?
So sure. And actually, you know, Brian, you really raised an interesting point, because I don't think it's so much about sort of a lack of presence and attention. It's just that the view in the Americas is often that the United States isn't present and working with them on the issues they care about the most, as opposed to not like what they hear from us plenty on migration. And there is no country in the Americas that has the same interest on migration that the United States has with respect to its southwest border. Right. I think you could, and that's just a reality. And there's no country in the region where it's so politically salient the way it is in the United States. That's fine. And they can understand that intellectually in other parts of the region. But then they say, well, what about trade and commercial development and investment, which is where we really want to talk. And so APEP, for instance, was really for a lot of those governments an insufficient response. But this is a really difficult space, because I think that there isn't a full appreciation in the region that free trade agreements are just a thing of the past for the United States right now. At least certainly it's a bipartisan consensus. the United States is very interested in resilient supply chains. Well, that starts in the Americas. And if we're not able to make progress there, then we're never going to be, it's never going to be as effective. And nearshoring will not be a reality without that kind of more structured, incentivized approach that requires something more than convenience, right? It requires actually working with Congress to create incentives, even if you're not going to have FTAs, and working with partners in the region to figure out how you make things real, for instance, in industrial policy. If critical minerals are a part, big part of U.S. industrial policy going forward, you can't have, for one example, an Inflation Reduction Act that doesn't include some kind of solution for Brazil, Argentina, as the biggest owners of critical minerals and supplies for exactly this industry.
You've touched on something that I always come back to, which is this idea that, again, on this question of whether the U.S. is engaging enough. Well, if you can't do new trade deals, it's almost like trying to engage with one hand tied behind your back. Because unlike Beijing, Washington cannot order its companies to go invest for either geopolitical reasons or some kind of long-term profitability. And the fact that the doors are closed on new free trade agreements, that's not the fault of the people running Latin America policy. That is the political reality of the United States today. For the first time since the post-war, neither party in Washington believes in free trade agreements today.
That's right. That's right. And so if you're talking about a second Biden term, you need a fix for that reality. Then that I would say is one of the main challenges. One is, and I think for, because industrial policy is going to be here for a while in the United States.
Well, but that's my question, Ricardo, is, I mean, is it just that the terminology has shifted somewhat, that instead of talking now about free trade agreements, we're talking about supply chain deals? They're not exactly the same, but is that what we might expect in terms of engagement in a second term?
It's what I would recommend highly. If you're not going to have free trade agreements, you need sectoral arrangements that are going to give some logic to supply chains and resilient supply chains. You can't have that without some kind of incentive. They will not happen organically. You have to create a framework that goes beyond the existing incentives or resources that are available through, for example, Ex-Im Bank or the DFC. You need a framework that gives a reason for suppliers to look at the United States as a potential market versus simply being an easy, available, and captive market for China. If you don't create that space, like, nature's going to take a course that you don't like.
Well, and I was surprised to see in the just published World Bank report on Latin America's economies, their contention that nearshoring in Mexico is actually not yet happening in a statistically significant way.
Well, I think Northern Mexicans would probably argue with that.
Well, and I there is, without diving too deep down that rabbit hole, there's some disagreement among economists as to whether that's the case. I was at a conference at Princeton last week where there was some debate about this, including economists who say, yes, it's clearly happening, it's just not in the data, which kind of blew my mind a little bit. But your broader point is that the U.S. government needs to take some concrete actions in order to encourage some of this nearshoring and make this supply chain integration possible.
Yes. Look, there are parts of the Americas Act, for instance, the draft legislation that is bipartisan in nature and has support that I know has, it's very much aimed at China. And if we can, like, that's a double-edged sword. But the reality is that it does represent one way of trying to create exactly this kind of framework, those sorts of incentive structures that go beyond the kind of what exists right now and what's available now, exactly because of the challenges the United States faces in not being, having a bunch of state-owned enterprises that you can just give a checkbook and say, go make uneconomic decisions because it'll pay off for us in, 30 years.
Ricardo, keeping this broad regional lens here, I want to ask you about China. in this era of increasing great power competition, how do you evaluate the way the Biden, and for that matter, previous administrations, have dealt with the growing Chinese presence in Latin America?
So China is a tough challenge for the United States in the region, because as you know, governments need and want a relationship with China. Just as the United States has a relationship with China, China has we have a strong commercial relationship with China. So do countries in the region. And they don't want to be asked to choose between the United States and China, which they feel that we often do, both in the Trump administration and the Biden administration. And to the United States, we have a different geopolitical outlook than most of the countries in the region have. We're preparing for potential conflict with China or in the Straits of Taiwan. And for other countries, that feels very, very remote. And we, the United States, have to look at the Chinese presence in the Americas and decide what we really want. Are we trying to exclude them altogether? That's not going to happen. They are now part of like sort of consortia economic agreements all over the region, et cetera. But it does make sense for the United States to try to alter what we view as harmful behavior in terms of predatory loans, in terms of, and most importantly, in terms of our presence in strategic parts of the economy, telecommunications being the most frequent example, but not just that. In electrical grid, port infrastructure, et cetera, there also needs to be perhaps a better understanding of the United States of China's goals. China's goals are to continue to feed itself from suppliers in the Americas, to continue to be able to get resources and commodities from the Americas. That's strategic for them. That's not like, you know, having ports that you can go to in the event of a conflict with the United States. It's making sure that you can feed your population. And so the United States, like, we need to be, I think, more sophisticated in terms of our messaging about what our concerns are with respect to China's presence in the Americas, and really zero in on those and make sure that our message is not just, you know, avoid that relationship altogether, because that's just not realistic.
It doesn't happen. I've said there is nothing less effective than an American on a stage wagging a finger at a Latin American audience on anything, right? But particularly on this topic of engagement with China. It sounds like self-interest as opposed to like you shouldn't be doing this for your own interest.
So we also don't want to be in a situation where we ask countries to choose in the middle of a crisis and find out to our consternation that we're not the one that's chosen, right? We don't want that. The whole objective here is not to be in a position where we force a choice where we might not like the answer.
We'll be back with more after a short break. The America's Quarterly Podcast is brought to you in part by the Council of the Americas. Every year, for 54 years now, the Council holds its Washington Conference, which gathers major figures from the U.S. government and companies from around the world to talk about Latin America's opportunities and challenges. Council members are automatically invited. For everybody else, you can either watch online or attend in person by buying a ticket. You can visit the Council's website. That's as-coa.org. Again, as-coa.org to learn more. All right, so let's go country by country now, and let's start with an easy one, Venezuela. Now, look, I mean, this is a difficult policy dilemma. It has vexed multiple administrations. It is not a problem of just this administration or the previous one, for that matter. But the most recent development on this was that the U.S. government did reimpose sanctions on Venezuela's oil sector because of the Maduro regime's failure to adhere to democratic principles ahead of so-called elections in July. It's a complicated story, Ricardo, and it's also one that's very dynamic. Even as we're recording this, the opposition has just settled on a candidate. The candidate may be disqualified by the time this episode is published. I mean, that's kind of the way these things have gone. But if we can just back up a little bit, another criticism that I've heard repeatedly over the last couple of years is that the Biden administration got played, that they got tricked, got outsmarted by Maduro on this. As somebody who was on the inside for at least part of this, I mean, what are the things that you saw perhaps people don't appreciate as much? And how do you see the policy towards that overall?
So the situation in Venezuela is something that is longstanding. It didn't start with the Trump administration. It didn't start with the Biden administration. It really dominated most of my 30-year career at the State Department in terms of the challenges that we faced in the region. And it was because we saw this slow dissolution of democracy in sort of bursts during the Chavez administration and really accelerated during the Maduro administration, where it really went down into what is now very clearly an autocratic government. And so the entire region has suffered because of it. There are 7 million Venezuelans on the road because of the social and political breakdown and economic breakdown of Venezuela. What the region really needs in Caracas is a government that they can work with. And for the United States, that means an elected government. Maduro is really unwilling to face that challenge of an open democratic election, or even a not fully democratic election. He understands that he is not likely to win the majority of the vote of the Venezuelan people. And that means that now we have to use the tools that we have available and support a very courageous and organized opposition, which we could not always say about Venezuela in terms of the level of organization, but they have proven that they are astute political actors, including with these recent moves.
The Trump administration tried a tougher approach. They tried the recognition of Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela. It is fair to point out that this was not a right-wing thing to do. Justin Trudeau, his government in Canada, also endorsed Guaido. This was something that had support from a lot of countries at the time. It failed. Now the Biden administration has tried to use kind of other incentives, including the possibility of more oil exploration, which would yield more revenues and economic growth. What is the real difficulty of this issue? I mean, is it just beyond the ability of any U.S. government to really affect change in Venezuela? Is that the core issue here?
Any U.S. government can influence what happens in Venezuela, but as in most parts of the world, the U.S. cannot or unilaterally determine an outcome. When you're dealing with a leadership that has a very minimal objective, which is to remain in power and to protect the economic interests and the political interests of a fairly small group of people, they can last a long time. And that we're talking about Venezuela, but an even smaller country like Nicaragua has been able to do this as well.
Is that why it looks sometimes like Maduro is one or two steps ahead of the U.S. and the opposition?
So I think that the United States understood, I think across actually multiple administrations, that it was a long shot to get the exact outcome that we wanted in Caracas. Always has been. It's a challenge more than any other time. And I really think that, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have wondered if, look, it's clear to me that the Biden administration, as the Trump administration, would rather see a democratic, with a lowercase d, government in Venezuela. But I have also wondered, watching the way that these negotiations have been handled over the last year, if the issues of immigration and energy security are in relative terms more important to the U.S. government than democracy.
Well, I think I would just point you to the decision that was just undertaken to reimpose, basically to let that license lapse.
Let's talk about Mexico. Undoubtedly, the most important relationship in the hemisphere for the United States, maybe in the world, some argue. As we were talking about earlier, Ricardo, it has surprised many people that there have seemed to be more disagreements between the U.S. and Mexico under a Democratic president than under a Republican one. When we had Carlos Trujillo on the podcast a couple of weeks ago to talk about, to preview for us what policy might look like toward Latin America if there's a second Trump term, I asked him several questions about this relationship, the AMLO-Trump relationship, because it was so surprising to me. I mean, again, from the perspective of somebody who is on the inside, have things, How do you view that AMLO-Trump dynamic? And also, you know, is the relationship between the Biden folks and the AMLO folks as frosty as it seems to be from the outside?
No. Mexico has been a really close partner of the Biden administration, and President Biden and President López Obrador do actually have a lot of synchronicity, and like they are both pro-labor. The United States has been important in terms of supporting many of the same labor goals that the López Obrador administration has advanced itself. On migration, Mexico and the United States have actually cooperated across the years. And I think that the Trump administration did not simply get its way with the López Obrador administration and everything they wanted. They had to negotiate as well, as does the Biden administration.
It's also, I mean, just to push on this one more time here, I mean, López Obrador has said several things over the years. He's denounced U.S. aid programs in Mexico as being interventionist. He's also been critical of the court cases facing Donald Trump, you know, essentially suggesting that they're politicized and that he's being persecuted. I do watch this as an observer sometimes and just kind of marvel and think to myself, how did that happen? I mean, you know, these guys who would seem to be in other ways ideologically very different, but there is some kind of bond between those two. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, look, I mean, I think that the reality is that the Biden administration has pursued a more orthodox foreign policy, where it also does defend things like democracy and human rights in ways that are bothersome to AMLO.
Looking ahead, of course, if President Biden wins the election in November, he will be dealing with a different Mexican president. The election is happening in Mexico in June. All signs indicate that AMLO's preferred candidate, Claudia Sheinbaum, is going to win that election comfortably. In the spirit of this episode, which is to look ahead as much as we look behind, I mean, what are there any issues, anything that you expect would be different if we have a second Biden term and Claudia Sheinbaum running Mexico?
I think that what you're going to see is, of course, there's going to be a focus on migration, but I think it's going to be much more about institutionalizing and expanding areas for legal pathways, like, for example, temporary labor programs. I think there's so much room for temporary labor programs at the regional level that that's a potentially an area of growth. I think that there has to be a new look at organized crime and the face of organized crime in the region, which is a much more sophisticated, much more multinational, much more heavily financed and integrated set of entities across the region, that I think that's going to require a regional response, at least at the scale that they've attempted on migration. And finally, on economics, like I said, this is not necessarily what a second term Biden administration would do, but I would heavily encourage a focus on consulting partners to see what can be done in the absence of new free trade agreements to actually make nearshoring and resilient supply chains a reality in a way that supports U.S. domestic economic interests.
Ricardo, we're kind of running out of time here, so let's do a lightning round now to try to touch on as many specific countries as we can. And let's go with Brazil first. This is a relationship you know well. You've worked on the ground. You were the consul in Sao Paulo. You worked in Brasilia. The Lula-Biden relationship has been interesting because on the one hand, Washington was one of the first places. In fact, I think it was the second place that Lula visited after he took office. But there have also been very public disagreements over issues like Ukraine, most of all, also to some extent, some of the statements that Lula has made about the war in Gaza and Israel. How would you characterize the relationship between those two, and how do you expect it to continue to evolve?
So, look, the relationship between Biden and Lula is actually quite good. It's positive. When Lula visited, U.S. labor leaders called Biden the most pro-labor president in U.S. history, and that made a real impact on Lula. And then when Biden proposed an international labor cooperation initiative, that really captured Lula's attention. I think that at that level, the relationship is good, but as so often is the case, there is a misunderstanding and a misapprehension in each capital about our respective geopolitical positions and interests. And this is, that was my bread and butter for years. And this relationship was translating in both directions because we just have very different outlooks.
What is it in your mind that U.S. officials sometimes don't get about Brazil and the way the world looks from there?
So I think that neutrality seems very strange in today's world. And of course, Brazil is a country that prizes its neutrality and it's having a standoff position. Brazil is a country that should be able to play in the BRICS as a Western democracy. That's good. But it should also be a country that is comfortably in the OECD because it is also that country. And so I think Brazil sometimes misses opportunities that it has because of this role that it's carved for itself. We're talking about a giant of the North in the industrialized world in the United States and a giant of the South, but also a Brazil that is probably increasingly relevant in a world where you have middle powers coming up. And it's not just the BRICS versus the G7. It's a much more complicated world. So I think that that's one area. And there are, I just think that even though there are often complementary interests, we don't give each other enough room to understand, to accept the differences in outlook as well. And that's, neither country can afford that now. We were successful Western democracies, challenged Western democracies. Like, we need each other now more than we have probably over the last 40, 50 years.
Colombia is a country that I know that President Biden understands well, that is important to him. He refers to it seemingly every time he talks about it in public as the keystone of South America. He was very involved in Plan Colombia when it was first approved back in the 1990s. He seems to get it. He has been dealing with a president who, in Gustavo Petro, who is different in many ways from traditional Colombian presidents. How has that relationship evolved basically since the election of Gustavo Petro, and considering the fact that Petro stood before the UN General Assembly and talked about the need to legalize drugs, you know, how has that all been handled?
Well, look, I think that for one, I think that there is a recognition in the Biden administration that for Petro, this is a domestic game first and foremost, and that he has ambitions on the social policy level to address, you know, challenges that have been longstanding in Colombia and where the United States has really invested over time as well, particularly in terms of extending the reach of the state and implementing the 2016 peace process. And the U.S. has made commitment across multiple administrations to make that a reality. And I think that that's been one important piece. And certainly there have been times where there's been real frustration from Washington regarding the statements and the direction of President Petro. But I'll just point this out. There is sometimes a challenging relationship between President Petro and some of his other counterparts, like President Lula, at times where they've been at cross purposes. So we aren't alone in sort of dealing with a different kind of government in Bogota.
As we get to the end here, I want to ask you about Cuba. It really seems like the status quo has kind of prevailed there since Biden took office. There has been very little, if no, movement back towards the policy of a rapprochement that characterized the final years of the Obama administration, a story of which you were a part. How to best understand the fact that there has been so little movement on Cuba? And would you expect anything to change in a second term where President Biden would no longer be worrying about his own reelection?
So let's look at the situation in Cuba really quickly. 400,000 plus Cubans have come to the United States or to the U.S. Southwest border in the last 18 months. That's about 5% of the population. Hunger is at an all-time high, much worse even in the special period after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There's two possible outcomes right now if you look at Cuba. One is a Haiti-like evolution where you have intense social collapse. And I mean, if you just look at the loss of power, of oil and electricity, and you may not have the kind of organized crime situation in Cuba, but you certainly will have the social conditions that exist. And that means permanent instability on the U.S. southern border, affecting the rest of the region as well. That's one outcome. Another outcome potentially is that in the absence of competition, even from within their own population, you'll have a Russian-style oligarchy emerge. And it's easy to see that. There is a reason that Oleg Deripaska set up shop and set up a economic reform institute in Cuba. That's not good news for U.S. interests. I would argue that it makes much more sense to empower Cuban citizens. And if you're going to be doing anything, give Cuban citizens the possibility of competing with the state by giving them greater economic power. That was what threatened Fidel Castro and why he rejected Obama's speech in 2015, which led to the ascendancy of the hardliners on the Cuban side. And then, of course, after Trump's election, the U.S. Ended up aligning with those people who also wanted to keep the status quo in Cuba. Unfortunately, that was not their objective, and I don't want to mischaracterize it that way, but that was the effect. The effect was that ordinary people lost agency in Cuba by losing access to resources from the outside. And so what we have now is a solution where if US goals included squeezing the Cuban economy, we've succeeded. The US sanctions have achieved, and in collaboration with a stale and really broken Cuban economic policy, Cuban government economic policy, have accomplished the collapse of the Cuban economy and the misery of 11 million Cubans who are fewer every day because they're picking up and leaving. Whether there will be a change in approach, I think, is going to be driven much more by circumstances and, for example, a much more visible mass migration. The other factor that's true in Cuba right now and that adds more instability is that the anger of the Cuban population towards their government is at the highest of any level that I've seen in 30 years. And so there's a lot of gasoline there. And it's just, there's too many matches close to that flame. And unfortunately, what that means, like, what does that scenario look like? If you have a real challenge to government, it looks like mass migration. It does not look like, you know, they are very, very good at suppression.
Final question for you, Ricardo. It's about Argentina, a place where I started my career. I know it's a place that you know and love as well. Javier Milei has built a functional relationship with the Biden administration at the same time that he is making no secret of his ideological preference for Donald Trump, speaking at CPAC conferences and doing other things to, you know, make clear his affinity for Elon Musk and sort of these other headline figures in the U.S. new right, if you will. If Biden does get reelected, do you expect there would be any residual, awkwardness between those two leaders, or will they be capable of putting that aside?
Well, look, every relationship is one that you look at from a perspective of opportunity. And in this one, this is an Argentina where, as whatever the position of President Milei, there are geopolitical opportunities to be had for the United States and the relationship with Argentina. And on top of that, I mean, the reality is that the United States needs to see some kind of, it's good for the United States and for the multilateral banking system to, and for the regional economy, to see the economy put on a, the Argentine economy put on a more sustainable path. Whether this is the one that's going to take it there is still open to question, and we'll see where it goes. But I will say that I think what you're going to look at is a pragmatic relationship between a second Biden administration and President Milei.
I can tell you were a diplomat for almost 30 years.
Well, yeah, look, it's hard to peel off. But the truth is, I mean, I actually think that if you really want to boil this down, what's the non-diplomatic way of putting this? You get what you can get in a relationship, and there's plenty to be had. Argentina and Argentina's success is really, really important.
Arguably true of several countries across the region as well. Ricardo, thank you so much for joining us on the AQ podcast.
Brian, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review, give us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly podcast is produced by Luisa Franco and edited in partnership with Human Group Media.